to today's SESMA podcast. My name is Dr. Kerri-Ann Walton. I'm very pleased to say that I'm no longer an aspiring but a qualified sports physician based in Hilton in KZN. Today I have the pleasure of welcoming two guests onto our show to talk to us about a very important and upcoming side of sports medicine, sports psychiatry. Our first guest is Dr. James Berger. James, I'm sure most of our listeners already know of you, but for those who don't, could I please ask you to give us a little background about how you became involved in sports psychiatry?
Thanks so much for having us on the podcast. It's great to be here. I guess I had a slightly unconventional journey with my early career, bouncing between sports medicine and psychiatry until I realized I didn't really have to choose one. I've always loved sports since I was young, so I leapt at the opportunity to be involved medically just after graduating when I was working in the Eastern Cape, and Conrad van Hagen helped me come on board as a team doctor at Eastern Province Rugby, which was great fun, and I learned a lot in that setup. And then when I came back to Cape Town, reconnected with my old rugby club, False Bay, and was the team doctor there, did a master's in sports medicine through Stellenbosch. But my main vocational passion has always been mental health and psychiatry. So I specialized in psychiatry through UCT, and I've been a clinical fellow at Groote Schuur Hospital in neuropsychiatry, and that's been for the last couple of years. With my interest in both sports medicine and psychiatry, I guess I was always drawn to come into the space that overlaps both, understanding the importance of looking at athletes holistically, not just their physical injuries, but also mental health. And neuropsychiatry in particular has natural links to sports psychiatry. I've got a particular interest in traumatic brain injury from sports and other settings. So like on the previous SASMA podcast with Lee Gordon, she mentioned the concussion clinic at Groote Schuur. That's been really exciting to be a part of. And then I'm also involved in some psychiatric care of athletes at Sports Science Institute of South Africa with a colleague of mine, Richard Gonzalez. And then in our neuropsychiatry division, we've been focusing more on behavioral medicine and health behaviors. So I do a lot of work with dementia as well as other patients who have comorbid medical and psychiatric conditions, where I think the role of exercise as medicine for both mental and physical health is particularly important. And then outside the clinical realm, I've become quite interested in how we create health systems that care for athletes and their mental health. And that's what we're doing as part of this sport and exercise psychiatry special interest group under our national psychiatry body. And I've also been lucky enough to be involved in kind of representing the South African context in the International Society for Sports Psychiatry. So trying to do a little bit more on the advocacy and advancing it in low and middle income countries.
Thank you, James. So joining James, we have Dr. Bonginkosi Mafuze. Bonginkosi, how is it that you became involved in the field of sports psychiatry?
Firstly, thank you, Kerri-Ann, for having us in this podcast. I guess my journey is also very similar to James. I think there's something about the Eastern Cape, but I think firstly, in congratulating you, I think my aspirations initially were to become a sports physician. I was also very inspired by Dr. Thulani Mbwenya, who's the current South African Football Association Chief Medical Officer. So during my community service year, I was in the Eastern Cape, and I had applied to do my master's in sports medicine in one of the universities. And then I got rejected at that time as someone who was very passionate in sports. So I was within the mental health space already. So I started reading, how can I integrate maybe my passion for sports and mental health? And then I came across sports psychiatry, and somehow, resoundingly, within a year or two, then I met James in Cape Town. And then that's when we figured, oh, okay, we can actually bring together the sports and exercise psychiatry field within our context. So it was more of sports psychology being like a rewarding field, which combines the science of mental health with my own passion for sports, obviously offering the opportunity to make a significant impact on athletes' lives and careers. So currently I'm involved with also with the International Society for Sports Psychiatry Youth Sports Committee. And yeah, that's how I ended up in sports psychiatry.
We thank you both for taking the time out of your busy schedules to share some of your knowledge with us today. Many of the listeners may be unfamiliar with the field of sports psychiatry. The first international consensus statement assists in breaking down the activity of a sports psychiatrist into three main fields. 1. Addressing mental health and disorders in competitive and elite sports. 2. Advocating physical activity in the prevention and treatment of mental health conditions. And 3. Addressing the sports-specific mental health symptoms and disorders that can emerge in recreational sports. James, would you like to share with us a bit about your dealings with competitive athletes and some of the problems that they have presented to you with?
Thanks. So competitive and elite athletes can have a wide range of mental health problems, but what we see most often are the appropriately named common mental disorders. And those are depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, substance use disorders. Most of these are found at similar rates to the general population, but we do see certain conditions that may be slightly more common within competitive and elite athletes, like the spectrum of disordered eating and eating disorders, as well as ADHD, which seems to be slightly more common amongst this cohort. Personality traits that can impact relationships, regulation of emotions, and general functioning are also relatively common, like they can be in the general population. So things like maladaptive perfectionism, avoidant behavior, those can come up often. Most athletes that present to psychiatry will have some sort of combination of stresses that have been coupled with a genetic predisposition to result in a mental disorder. And that mental disorder is then impacting their lives, their sports, relationships, all causing them significant distress. Not everyone I see has a mental disorder. There's a spectrum of mental health, and well-being and mental illness are the two poles of that. And at times there are somewhat normal stress responses to difficult situations that we see. Athletes are human first. They can experience a whole range of life stresses, including relationship stress, financial stress, trauma, death of loved ones, as well as these additional competitive and performance stresses, travel and logistic stresses, and then the massive public and media scrutiny that they face as well. And another thing that we are seeing more of and is coming more into the light is how there are some specific vulnerabilities in athlete systems that can result in the abuse of athletes, with the potential for developing trauma responses like PTSD. And there are certain times when there's increased stress in athletes and they might be more likely to present with mental health symptoms. So times are following injury, after performance problems, particularly if it's high profile performance difficulties, or in retirement. Retirement is also a particularly challenging career transition, and that's exacerbated when it hasn't been planned. So for an example, in an injury, a concussion can be a particular challenge where athletes develop a more cognitive and emotional profile of symptoms following their injury. That is something that's a possibility. And that's particularly common when there's a pre-existing history of mental health conditions like major depressive disorder. However, some can develop a mental health condition de novo. So they likely have a mix of biological factors from the injury together with psychological and social stresses that come with being injured, being removed from a team environment, and not being able to exercise like you usually do, and concern about the future. So there's a whole range of mental health problems that can arise, and many of them will need treatment in some shape and form. We unfortunately still need to do a lot of education to improve mental health literacy in athletes and coaches to try and close this gap between those who want treatment and those who end up receiving it, what we call the treatment gap. But we are slowly starting to see a shift in how willing athletes are to talk about mental health and to seek help.
Thank you, James. Bong and Corsi, we are all aware of the overwhelming pressure these athletes must deal with. Their ability to manage this and not lose their heads prior to even starting a competition is quite something. Do you have any advice to share when it comes to managing athlete mental health before or during a competition?
Thanks, Kerry. I think that's a very interesting question. But I think just to put it out there initially, athletes don't exist in silos. I think our approach needs to be a very broad one, looking at, like how James mentioned, the coaches involved, the team structure involved, friends and family that are related to the athlete, but trying to be very specific to the question as to how an athlete can prepare mentally is somehow similar to how you train physically for any particular performance. So there are various ways in which an athlete can train their mind to be ready before competition, during competition, and after competition. So perhaps maybe I could mention some of a few things you can do prior to competition. So you could do some mental preparation and visualization techniques where maybe the athlete can mentally rehearse their performance. This helps them to visualize and build confidence, which can help reduce anxiety because they are familiarizing their mind with the competition environment and perhaps the desired outcomes that they may have. And in conjunction with this is possibly goal settings, obviously setting very realistic process-orientated goals rather than outcome-based goals, because sport is more of a process. It's a career, it's a journey. It's never about just one game. There's many games that do come after that particular performance. So we really try and stick to the process rather than the outcome of that particular tournament or event. There's also mindfulness and relaxation techniques. I think you would see some of the athletes recently in the Olympics, before they run, they take deep breaths in, even during swimming and different sports. So there are deep breathing techniques that an athlete can undergo, which are usually supervised or taught by a sports psychologist or other mental health practitioners within the athlete's space. There's mindfulness meditation that athletes can incorporate into their training routine, and also positive self-talk. Tell yourself, I'm prepared for this season. I'm prepared for this game. I can handle this, you know? So to reinforce like a positive mindset. And then obviously the same with training physically, routine and consistency is very, very important for an athlete to prepare. So the athletes probably need to develop like a consistent routine, which includes the mental preparation I've talked about, the relaxation technique. And this assists by providing a familiar environment and makes the athletes feel in control whenever they undergo through this process or routine, rather than it being something new that they only do prior to a match or prior to a game type of situation. And I think most important also is managing expectations and the pressure before the competition. So we need to encourage athletes to focus on their own goals and not to let like external pressure dictate their performance. And this can usually come from the coaches, it can come from media, it could come from fans. So it's really important that at the end of the day, as an athlete, you strive to be better than who you were the previous game or the previous tournament, but it always has to be about your own personal improvement. And then obviously contingency planning, anything can happen in a game. You have to prepare and expect some of the worst outcomes. So preparing for adversity can assist athletes mentally for potential setbacks or unexpected challenges during the competition. So it's always good to like have a plan for how to respond and reduce the anxiety, which can help the athlete stay focused. This is amongst many others. And then obviously after the competition, it's always important to reflect and learn from what you've gone through. And then always accessing professional support, being physios, sports physicians, sports psychologists, sports psychiatrists, and having access to mental health resources to address any mental health challenges that the athlete may face. So I think these are some strategies which can help an athlete to maintain mental clarity, confidence, and composure before and during any competition.
Thank you, Bongi Nkosi. This is very helpful. Then, James, could I please ask you to highlight some of the red flags that we should always keep an eye out for when dealing with athletes?
So in terms of red flags for mental health conditions, we need to be on the lookout for when an athlete or any member of an entourage, for that matter, experience negative changes in their thoughts, in their feelings, their behaviors, or in their physical state. Another clue could be performance challenges. Performance challenges can cause both stress and mental health symptoms, as well as being a result of an underlying mental health condition. So underperformance might be an early sign of one of those presenting. Most of the SASMA audience would have heard of the IOC SMAT and SMERTS, the two screening tools that have recently come out. Those are useful if you want to look at some of the types of symptoms and screening mechanisms that could help you to start conversations. They're not perfect, but they can be useful. And the IOC Mental Health Working Group are revising them and continue to build on some solid foundations. We also did some work in looking at the sport concussion assessment tool, the SCAT, and the symptom evaluation there has a number of emotional, sleep, cognitive, physical symptoms that can help you actually to detect mental health symptoms in that setting. So using what is available to you, so maybe it's a bit unorthodox, but concussion assessment tools as a starting point and a launch pad for conversations, that can be helpful. In terms of true red flags, of particular note would be thoughts of hopelessness, death, suicidal ideation, self-injury. We're sometimes nervous as medical practitioners to ask about these, but would encourage the practitioners listening to do it non-judgmentally and from trying to understand what the athlete is going through. You aren't going to plant the idea into the athlete's mind, but it might help them to get it off their chest. And also for you as a practitioner to get a better idea about risk and what the management needs to be. And remember, if you're not sure what to do, discuss it with a psychiatrist or a psychologist that you work with and plan for these types of scenarios. So we've been involved in developing some mental health action plans for some of the local sports organizations. And that's something our group can also help with people who want to reach out and think through some of those kind of standard operating procedures and processes that might be able to equip you.
Thank you, James. Really nice to hear you saying that when one inquires about the red flags that we're always most concerned about, suicidal ideation, that it isn't thought of as encouraging the ideal. I think most people are often too frightened to ask. Then Bongen Kosi, how would you go about managing a competitive athlete that is referred on to you?
Okay, I think that's a very good question. So just like how you would treat a general population non-competitive athlete or someone in society, it really requires a tailored approach that suits that athlete, which obviously would consider unique pressures and demands of the particular athlete. But the approach is usually the same. You take a very thorough history and evaluation. So trying to understand what mental health challenges does this athlete really have. You could risk stratify them, whether is it a mild, moderate, or severe condition. And then how is this mental health challenge affecting the athlete performance? And most importantly, as you're saying, this client has been referred to you. It's very important to build rapport with the athlete and ensure confidentiality, because you need to clearly explain the limits of the confidentiality, especially if the referral came from the coach or from the team. So athletes also need to feel secure that their privacy with you is respected. Because when it comes to mental health, we delve into the deepest of secrets of individuals, which is very different from physical ailments where everyone can see that, oh, the ankle is broken. But when it comes to the red flags that James spoke about, it really takes a lot for them to come out and be vulnerable or make themselves vulnerable by sharing some of their experiences. And then with history, examination, investigations, then you develop a treatment plan for this athlete. And again, it's very individualized. And I think one of the most important things that we need to consider is that if you want to put an athlete on any type of treatment or medication, one needs to consider the WADA list of drugs, so the World Anti-Doping Agency. So sometimes you may be putting someone on, let's say maybe you have an athlete who suffers from ADHD, you know, and then you want to prescribe them a stimulant. And stimulants, there's certain levels of stimulants that you can use in competition and out of competition. So you need to make sure that you apply for therapeutic use exemption. So it's not always just about treating the conditions, but knowing that if you enhance performance of a particular athlete, it may give them challenges when they have to go out there and perform other athletes. And then obviously setting goals with your athlete. So set both short-term and long-term mental health goals. Perhaps say after 2 games, where do you hope to be? After 4 games, where do you hope to be? So something that can be very realistic, and making sure that we incorporate sport-specific interventions for the athletes. So something that is aligned with the athlete's training and competition schedule. Because you may find instances sometimes that your athlete has traveled abroad to go participate in a month-long tournament. So you need to know what measures you need to put in place. Will you do virtual consultations, or are you going to keep track of a daily plan that the patient has to go through? So one needs to consider all of those things. But at the end of the day, in managing athletes, you are not alone as the treating doctor or the treating psychiatrist. It really takes a multidisciplinary team approach. So you need to make sure you involve all the different stakeholders in managing that multidisciplinary approach to the athlete. And then, like I've mentioned, monitoring and following up of the athlete, making sure you have plans in place to institute whenever there needs to be crisis management. Athlete has now had a severe depressive episode. They're feeling suicidal. You need to have an action plan on how can they do this if they are not in the country or they are elsewhere. There needs to be safeguard measures that athletes can look forward to and prevent them from looking at other maladaptive coping skills, like maybe substance misuse, to try and treat their problems. And then obviously in managing an athlete, one really needs to consider the transitioning and long-term support. So you need to look at the level where your athlete is. Is my athlete moving from pro to elite? Are they moving from university to national, or are they moving to international? So that transitioning phase can also bring about a lot of mental health challenges. So we need to make sure we have long-term support. And sometimes James mentioned that there may be physical injuries that may bring about mental health challenges. And then now an athlete is thinking about retirement, and maybe they were expecting to retire in 5 or 10 years time. Then now they are faced with retirement in the immediate short term. So we need to make sure we create supportive environments for athletes, even when they go through such problems. But most importantly is to also maintain professional boundaries. As a treating psychiatrist for a particular team or an individual in sports, you need to avoid the dual relationship and ensure that the athlete's welfare is the primary goal or the primary focus.
Thank you, Bong and Kosi. So I know you touched on this, but the medical treatment of competitive athletes obviously comes with additional complexities. James, are there any medications you favor or don't advise for your more common mental health symptoms or disorders?
It's a really important question, and I think Bong and Kosi really set the scene well there and emphasizing how we have a biopsychosocial approach to management based on a comprehensive assessment. And it always needs to start with a good, solid assessment. Certain athletes may require medications as part of that holistic management plan. This is something that a lot of general practitioners are becoming more and more au fait with, is particularly in South Africa, where we have specialist psychiatrists being in short supply, particularly when you are further narrowing it down to someone who has a particular interest or expertise in the sports context, and there likely needs to be some task sharing with generalists like sports physicians. So this is conversations that we can have according to the individual, but in general, treatment choices should be evidence-based, so targeted at the particular mental health condition that you're wanting to treat. Unfortunately, we have very little in terms of specific evidence in athletes in the literature. So most of it is extrapolated from trials in the general population, with tweaks according to our understandings of the mechanisms of the medications, side effect profiles, as well as exercise physiology. And we always try to limit side effects and performance effects. However, health trumps performance, and that needs to be the priority. In fact, appropriately treating mental health disorders would likely have benefits of restoring and maintaining performance rather than detrimental effects overall. So performance comes in, but we need to focus on making sure athletes are healthy. Using the example of depression, that's a very common condition that we see in athletes. Milder forms can be managed with guided self-help, internet-based cognitive behavior therapy, appropriate amounts of exercise, and so on. All of the things Bong and Kosi was talking about. Psychotherapy is also something that we must consider, and that's often first line, such as cognitive behavior therapy or acceptance commitment therapy, and involvement of clinical psychologists might be useful for these talk therapies. When it comes to more moderate to severe depressions that warrant medication, we typically use SSRIs as first line. So common examples are sertraline, escitalopram, and others. SNRIs like venlafaxine and NDRIs like bupropion are also reasonable choices in athletes. Relatively good side effect profiles, safety profiles, and minimal performance effects or detrimental performance effects. And like Bongiwase mentioned, it's really important to ensure that any medication is in line with the WADA code and keep updated with AND lists. The stimulants is the classic example, but additionally, other medications like bupropion, that's often advocated for as a useful agent for depression in athletes, but it's currently on the WADA watch list. So you need to constantly update, especially if you're prescribing for athletes. Don't just assume that because it's been okay before, it's going to continue to be okay. And to answer your question about things to avoid, be very careful about off-label prescribing, and especially as a generalist. So involve a MDT around you. But an example is particularly with the rise of ketamine clinics in non-specialist settings, and remembering that ketamine is currently only approved for treatment-resistant depression, and therefore a psychiatrist should be involved in the care if you're using that as a treatment. And there are some additional anti-doping considerations that, although ketamine is not banned, IV methods require TUEs as well. So that's something that can trip people up. And similarly, psilocybin and other hallucinogens have become quite popular in kind of lay media and also even in professional circles as well. But those are restricted to research settings in terms of their approval. So just be very careful about going off-label and thinking that through and double-check with the team around you.
Thanks, James. Now, if we move on to the use of exercise in the prevention and treatment of mental health conditions, Bongiwase, how have you found exercise to be beneficial when treating mental health conditions?
Whether there's a mental health condition or not, I believe exercise is quite important and assists in improving your mood and reduces anxiety. I think if any of us as my listener may know how good you feel after an exercise or a routine that you've done, be it morning or in the afternoon. So what exercise does is it helps with endorphin release. And these endorphins are natural mood elevators in the body. So they can help improve low mood or any anxiety. So also exercise helps reduce stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to feelings of being calm and feeling relaxed. Exercise can also assist in enhancing sleep quality. Very important for athletes, ensuring sleep. As much as we exercise, we need to make sure we sleep. Jet lag can get through to our athlete. And so I think a good training coach will know when to induce or instruct the athlete to go and do a particular type of physical exercise just to ensure that the sleep quality of the athlete is also enhanced. Also, physical activity in athletes can assist in boosting self-esteem and confidence. If you do something repeatedly in the gym or in your routine and your training, you really become confident even doing it during competition because you become so comfortable in repeating that and it's something that you've done before. And what I really advocate within these exercise routines is to try and introduce perhaps group types of exercise. So in helping mental health, it assists in social interaction and support. So team sports usually have this going on very well, where if you're training together as a team, you exercise together as a team. It may be a bit difficult in individual sports, maybe something like golf or swimming, where something you are doing it on your own. So we really encourage social interaction during these exercises, and that's where you gain support. But also, I think exercise can be a healthy coping mechanism. I think adapted mostly from ADHD, where exercise is used as a treatment option, as a positive outlet of stress for the individual. So I think it's something that can be quite useful. And in supporting treatment of specific conditions, exercise can be used in the treatment of depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, or ADHD, like I just mentioned.
Thank you, Bongan Kosi. And now for the tricky one, which I think even in the general population, how do you get your patients or even the public to partake in it and maintain it?
Definitely, that's a tricky one. The first thing I'm thinking of is possibly introduce a prize or a reward for them to make sure that they participate in it. But truly speaking, it starts with education and awareness. So teaching people on the benefits of exercise, making them aware of what it can help with and how it can assist in the athlete's growth, even for non-athletes, like you're saying, even for the public. And however, it's very important to personalize the approach. So we may say to an athlete, you need to run 100 meters in 11 seconds. I can't say that to a general public person because that's not very personalized to them, or to do squats while carrying 100 kilograms on your back. I mean, you're not a scrum of a rugby team. So we really need to personalize the approach to the exercise to make sure that it's useful and appropriate for the person that you are wanting to take up on that. And also we need to make sure we know why people don't exercise. So we need to address the barriers and the challenges that make people not want to exercise, because we can't just keep on saying exercise is important. Maybe there's an underlying injury, there's underlying trauma that someone may have, or they have an underlying medical condition. So we really need to make sure that we address the barriers and challenges that make people resistant towards exercise. A good way to get your patient or the public in is to incorporate exercise into daily routine. So routine really makes things seem effortless. So it's either one, you get reminders on your mobile phone that tells you, hey, it's 5 a.m., it's time to go exercise, or hey, it's 5 p.m., let's go exercise. Or maybe perhaps even not doing a formal exercise, but even at work, taking the stairs instead of using the lift, or maybe cycling instead of taking a vehicle, you know? So it starts with small things like that. And we need to promote social and group activities in these. And I think nowadays it's very appropriate that we incorporate technology into how we can get people involved in exercise. So fitness apps and trackers, there's different apps that people use. They compete amongst each other, or you count the amount of steps that you've done. I think even some corporates, or what you call, even some companies, they'll give you extra points if you've taken a certain number of steps towards your health. So health insurances can assist you as a reward type of system to make sure that you continue exercising. And me as a practitioner, I need to lead by example. I can't be sitting there and being someone who doesn't exercise and encouraging other people to exercise. So also, you need to be someone who leads by example.
This is very true. So lastly, we rightly need to remember that not all athletes are competitive and can also just be doing exercise recreationally. James, can you please talk us through some of the mental health symptoms and disorders that can emerge in more recreational athletes?
Yeah, definitely. So as we're continuing to advocate for more people to exercise, more people are going to be classified as recreational athletes. Overall, exercise is good for your mental health. Like Bongan Kosi mentioned, it can help prevent and treat mental health symptoms and disorders. But these disorders do still happen and may require treatment. And in addition, there are a few types of problems that we need to be on the lookout for in certain sports settings. Some of the common things to think about are compulsive exercise as a kind of form of addictive exercise behaviors, and disordered eating spectrums linked with that as well. Image and performance enhancing drugs like anabolic steroid use are often more common than you would think in recreational settings. Linked with that, muscle dysmorphia as a type of body dysmorphic disorder. And then we've spoken briefly about concussion, but recreational athletes in various collision and contact sports can have concussions and have neuropsychiatric symptoms from there. As positive as many of these sports environments are, especially in team settings, for example, There are some substance use disorders and binge pattern alcohol use that are quite common in team sport settings. South Africa is a country where that is a common occurrence. And you've got these various different conditions that are somewhat more sport specific, as well as the common mental disorders as well. Overall, with exercise being beneficial and these recreational settings, Bong Nkosi mentioned the social elements of sport and how important that is. There's also an opportunity for these recreational settings to have opportunities for health and support, which is something we're seeing in certain community sports clubs developing support networks for their members. So, for example, a great initiative that False Bay Rugby Club has started is an outreach committee that has been trained in psychological first aid. They aim to provide some basic support and linking with appropriate psychosocial services. So as much as you can have mental health problems that are there, you can also have these mental health supports that are somewhat more formalized in addition to just the benefits of exercise and socialization as well. So as we are getting people to work positively in their mental health, it's going to be an interesting space to see as more and more people being active.
Thank you, James. As we close off, do each of you have any additional pearls of wisdom that you would like to share with the listeners?
The first thing that I would think of is just to be curious as a practitioner, as a person. Don't shy away from asking about mental health. Even if it's something you're not completely comfortable with, just lean into that discomfort and take the opportunities to upskill yourself. The International Society for Sports Psychiatry has a certificate of further training. The IOC has a diploma in mental health and elite sport. And then surround yourself with a team and we can work together. So know the resources around you. And that includes in the exercise for mental health space. There are a number of NGOs that are involved in the boundaries of sports and mental health. So Waves for Change, Dance for Parkinson's and others. And if there are SASMA members who are wanting to join our sport and exercise psychiatry WhatsApp group, reach out and we can add you. We're also going to be trying to upskill the community through hosting some more SASMA podcasts with the spotlight on sport and exercise psychiatry. And then we're also needing more research locally. If you're doing something in mental health, get it into the published literature. Similarly, if you're working in the mental health space, get people moving and talk about it in research. So I think it's an exciting space that's growing, and surround yourself with like-minded people and we can really take it forward together.
Okay. I think maybe because James is adding on more towards the professionals, maybe I could add on some pearls of wisdom for recreational and competitive athletes who might be listening, or perhaps maybe that we could advise our athlete that we may see on the consultation room. So firstly, it would be consistency over perfection. We will go through challenges as athletes. So it's all about consistency rather than always be perfect. And that as an individual participating in sport, one needs to take note of the mind-body connection. So you need to listen to your body. Meditation and yoga really help to enhance this connection. What happens physically will affect you mentally. If you're not strong mentally, it'll affect your performance physically. And obviously in the sports, find joy in moving or in being in doing any activity and celebrate the small wins. You may have a personal best, but you are not first. Celebrate those small wins. It's not always just about the outcome, and keep moving forward.
Thank you. Then I'm sure all the listeners still have a million questions that they would like to ask. Should a colleague wish to contact you for some advice in this field or find you on social media, how could they go about this?
Thanks again for the opportunity to chat. Would be more than happy to discuss further if anyone is interested or keen to collaborate. If you want to reach me, I am on Twitter at James W. Berger. Otherwise, you could email me at james.berger@uct.ac.za, or our SEPSIG group is sepsigsasop@gmail.com. And then we could also just put a few of the recent articles in sports psychiatry into the show notes. Maybe that'll be interesting for some of the listeners.
Yeah, thanks really again for hosting us, Kerry. Should anyone have any question, I'm also available on email at bmafuze@gmail.com. On the socials, it's at Dr. Mafuze on X. It's X, James. And Instagram, it's at Dr. Mafuze. On Facebook, it's Bonginkosi Martin Mkhize. Thank you so much.
And then Bonginkosi, I think you may be involved in a podcast yourself. Would you like to share?
Yes. Oh, yes. We can also check out my podcast on lived experiences. It's on YouTube. It's called Doctors of Minds. So we should be hosting some athletes at some point. Thank you.
That sounds great. I'm sure the listeners are looking forward to listening to this too. Thank you both again for joining us today. I hope everyone listening has enjoyed and gained something from the podcast. I wish you both the best of the luck in this exciting field and hope we get to work together again soon.